Hopefully this works. Okay, so good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out. Thank you for inviting me to give a talk. Can everyone hear all right? Can't hear all right? Hello, hello. If it gets more close, I'm going to be eating it. Yeah, maybe I just have to speak up. So, the topic of tonight's talk is one of my, one that's it's a talk that I give often, so pardon me if you've heard this already, but it's always nice to give, to go over these teachings again. The question I'm going to be answering tonight is, what does it mean to live by the Dhamma? What sort of a person do you consider someone who lives by the Dhamma? So in the time of the Buddha, monks would come to the Buddha with questions, of course. And one time when this monk came to the Buddha and asked him, Dhammavihari, to what extent is someone called a Dhammavihari? So the word Dhamma, we know Dhamma. Dhamma means the truth or the teachings of the Buddha. This is called the Dhamma. Vihari means like this is a vihara. Why we call this a vihara? Because it's a place where someone dwells. This is a dwelling. Where monks dwell, they call the vihara. Like the Brahma viharas are the dwelling like Brahma or with Brahma or as Brahma or the way Brahma dwells. But what do you call a Dhamma vihari? We know Brahma vihari. That you have to practice metta, karuna, no? How do you become a Dhamma vihari? How do you really live by the Dhamma? So the Buddha didn't answer him directly, which is common of the Buddha. The Buddha said there are four ways of answering questions. Some questions you have to answer directly. Some questions you have to put aside. Some questions you have to explain something else first. You have to say, well, before I answer that, you have to understand this. Some questions you have to answer with a counter question. So you ask me this, I ask you, well, ask you something in return. The Buddha would answer that way. So this was a case where he had to explain first. Rather than tell him right away what is someone who lives by the Dhamma, he said, in all there are four types of people in the world. Sorry, let's say four or five types of people in the world. The first type of person, he said, imagine there's this monk who studies all of the Buddha's teachings. They take their time and go through all of the teachings, the sutta, the geya, all the different forms of the Buddha's teachings. And now today we have this in what we call the Tipitaka. So we have some prose, we have some verse, we have some inspired utterances, we got past life stories, we got the Dhammapada. So many different kinds, all of these teachings, studies all of these. And then that person does nothing else. They study and they're content with their study. And they think, wow, now I have the Dhamma. In the Buddha's time, there was a monk. I have stories for each of these. So, in the Buddha's time, there was a monk called Tuccapotila. Does anybody know the story of Tuccapotila? You ever heard the story of Potila? There was a book on this, right? You know that one modern teacher, I thought it was Ajahn Chah. So Potila means book or manuscript or something. And it was an apt sort of name because he was really keen on studying the Buddha's teaching. He studied all of it. He's just, as I said, this is the sort of monk. And he became quite well known for this, for being well versed in the Buddha's teaching. And he was quite proud of his knowledge. And so he thought, well, I'll go see the Buddha and we'll hang out, us two Dhamma farers. Surely he will appreciate seeing me, someone who has studied all of his teachings and kept it in mind. And so he went to see the Buddha. And the Buddha said, oh, here comes Tuccapotila. Tuccha means empty. So his name is Potila. The Buddha called him Empty Book. Here comes Empty Book. And Potila was sort of disconcerted. Maybe I didn't hear that right. So he sits down and he said, hello, Empty Book. And he was really sort of kind of flustered, and his face turned red, and he kind of bowed to the Buddha. And he said, Sadhu, Empty Book. Bows down to the Buddha, and then so he's kind of upset, why is the Buddha calling me Empty Book? And so he gets up and he says, oh, there goes, goodbye, Empty Book. And he's thinking, how can this be? Why is the Buddha calling me Empty Book? I'm full. I've got it all. And so he was very embarrassed, and he went on his own, and he realized that in truth he hadn't gained anything, right? It's like a person who has this great map that leads to, let's say, a pirate map that leads to buried treasure. And he sits at home and he memorizes the map and he tells other people at the map or whatever. He has this map completely memorized and he feels happy about that. He says, realize that's sort of what I'm like. I'm just completely empty because I have no experience. Knowledge in Buddhism is, there are two kinds of knowledge, right? There's intellectual knowledge where you reason something out or you hear it and you memorize it. But then there's real knowledge, where you really know something, where you've seen it for yourself, where you've followed the map. And he said, I don't have any of that. And so he kind of lost his ego at that point. He was humiliated and humbled. And so he, but still kind of had this sense of, he was struggling with this. And so he goes off to this very well-known monastery where there are these 30 well-known monks who are very strong in their meditation. It turns out they're all arahants. These 30 monks are all arahants. He goes to the forest to see them. And he goes straight to the head monk, the most senior monk. And he says, Bhante, please teach me. And this head monk looks at him and thinks to himself, oh, this Potila, he's so full of himself. He thought he memorized all the Buddha's teachings. I think I'll have to make sure he's humbled. Make sure he's completely humbled. And so he said, I'm sorry, I can't teach you. You go to the second monk. Go find this monk. He's the second in charge. And he goes to the second monk, and the second monk looks, is also an arahant, and he also looks at him and thinks the same thing, and so he sends him to the third monk. all the way down the line to the 30th monk, and the 30th monk is this new monk. And even he says, I'm sorry, Venerable Sir, I can't teach you. And at this point, he's at his wit's end, he's quite desperate. And so he says, please, isn't there something you can do? He said, well, there's this novice. There's a 7-year-old novice playing down by the water. You could go ask him. Maybe he'll teach you. Totally humiliating him, right? Turns out the novice is also an arahant. And so he goes down to the pool, and he bows down to this novice, and the novice is like, Bhante, what are you doing? You're not supposed to bow down to me. And he says, please, you've been recommended by the monks in this monastery. Please teach me the Dhamma. And the novice looks at him and he thinks, Because once you've learned so much, immediately you say, I know that. The teacher teaches you something, I know that. Rather than exploring it and finding it for yourself and really learning it from within, you know. The intellect jumps on. So it's very hard to teach people who have learned. There was this monk in Thailand. He told the story. He was a top scholar in Thailand. He was the only monk in his year who passed the final exam in Pali, in the whole country. Everybody else failed. In fact, everybody failed, but he failed the least, and they said, well, we have to pass someone, so we'll pass him. The exams are that hard. But he was the top. And he went to practice meditation. And it was clear that he was having some trouble, and so his teacher said, you know, if I had to charge people for meditation, I would charge people who had never studied, who had never learned the Dhamma, 6 baht. And I would charge people who had learned the Dhamma, 12 baht. And he said, Ajahn, that's not fair, that's not right. How can you? And he says, of course it's right. Those who have people who have studied argue with their teacher. He's like, And so he tells that story. It's true, because if you learn a lot, it can easily get in the way. So this novice says to Bhojila, he says, all right, I'll teach you, but you have to do exactly what I say. Whatever I tell you to do, you have to do. He said, fine, of course. What are you going to do, get me to sit and meditate? Sure. So what does he do? You remember the story? He says, run down into the middle of the pond. And Bhojila says, what? You promise. And so he starts to take off. He says, no, just go into the water with your robes, that's fine. And so Bhojila is at his wit's end, so he walks into the water, into the middle of this pond, and standing there wet. And the novice says, okay, come on out. Okay, so he comes out. He says, okay, go back in again. He goes back in. Come on out. Go in. And he has him go back in and out like 5 or 6 times. Totally. You know, you just don't do that to a monk. He's basically humiliating this guy. And finally, he sends him out into the middle of the lake, and he says to him, suppose you had an anthill, a termite mound, and apparently these lizards go into the termite mounds to eat the termites. So suppose you have a termite mound with 6 holes, and a lizard goes into 1 hole. How do you catch the lizard? Bhojila's standing there up to his neck in water. And he says, well, I suppose you close 5 of the holes and you guard the 6th hole. And he says, okay. In the same way, you think of the mind. The 6 holes are the 6 senses. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. Close 5 of them. It means don't let your mind go through those doors. When you see, let it just be seeing. When you hear, let it just be hearing. And you guard the mind wherever it goes. And when the mind comes out, you catch the mind as the 6th. You watch the mind. Don't worry about the other 5. Just watch the mind. And Potila, standing there in the middle of this lake, he starts to practice and he actually becomes enlightened. Which is, it's an interesting story for that reason alone, that all the teachings that he had gained, all this profound, if you read these books, they're quite profound, profound teachings, in the end did him very little. And this simple teaching of a termite mound, this is according to the story, this is all it took. And some running out in and out of the lake. That's the story of Dujjapotila. So the Buddha said, this sort of person who studies and does nothing with it, this is called a Pariyatti Bahulo, not a Dhamma Vihari. Pariyatti Bahulo means has a lot of learning. That's what they're called. They're not called a Dhamma Vihari. It's not someone who lives by the Dhamma. That's the first thing. First type of person. The second type of person studies and then they teach. You know the old adage, if you can't, those who can't do, teach. Those who can do, those who can't teach, is that how it goes? So they learn all this and then they teach it to others, and it's kind of like simulating enlightenment, because you're able to parrot back all these teachings and explain them and so on, and it feels like you're enlightened. Because people are like, wow, that's profound. I'm like, I know. And you can pass along these teachings. And so it's easy to get into this state of feeling that maybe you're enlightened. Like, there was a Bahia, the story of Bahia. He thought he was enlightened just because he was naked. This guy was shipwrecked. And then he had no clothes because he had discarded his clothes to swim to shore. When he gets to shore, he just wears some piece of pottery or a bark or something to cover him himself, and people think he's some kind of sadhu or some kind of rishi, some kind of sage, because they went naked, right? And so he starts to think, yeah, maybe I am. Well, in the beginning, he just goes along with it, and eventually he gets this idea that maybe he is somehow enlightened. But the story for this one, in regards to teaching, how teaching can often make you feel like you're somehow special. There's another story of a monk, a lot like Potila. He had learned a lot, but he also taught, and he was a very famous teacher. All of his students, in fact, every single one of his students had become enlightened. Some were Sotapanna, some were Sakadagami, some were Anagami. I can't remember, some were arahant, but they had all found the goal, had all seen Nibbana. And so he was quite happy with his life. He was very busy teaching, every day teaching. And he was well respected. Everyone thought, wow, this is a real Buddhist teacher. So one day, one of his students was sitting, an Anagami who had magical powers and everything, was sitting in his room, and he started to think, I wonder what level of attainment our teacher has attained. So he closed his eyes and he sent his mind out, and he realized our teacher is still an ordinary worldling. He hasn't gained anything from the practice. Now you'd be surprised. People think, well, if you're a great teacher, you must be enlightened. It's actually not necessarily the case. If you just pass on the Buddha's teaching, and if you're eloquent, if you're well-spoken, if you've got a good mind, and you're charismatic, you can teach. It's a skill, but it's not the same skill as practice. So this guy was still an ordinary person. And this Anagami student said, I got to do something about this. This isn't right. And so he walked into the teacher's room, calm as an Anagami. Anagami are very special people. They have no greed, they have no anger. No sensual desire and no anger. And so he says to the teacher says, yes, what is it? He says, I've come for a lesson. And the teacher says, it's not time for a lesson. I'm sorry, I have no time to teach you anything. He says, no, I have a lesson for you. You don't have time for anyone. You don't have time for yourself. How can you make time for others when you haven't ever even taken the time for yourself? And he sits cross-legged and he levitates. This is the story, you can believe it or not. He levitates into the air and flies out the window. Just to prove a point. Like, you haven't gotten anything. You've gotten nowhere. And the teacher kind of freezes and is shaken by this and realizes, you know, this is true. I'm nothing. Like, he's never seen anyone fly through a window, I suppose. It's quite impressive. And it shakes him, and he can't shake that, you know, the words of this student of his. And so he realizes he has to do something, and he leaves. He tells his student he's going on vacation, and he just leaves and goes and lives in the forest. And he works very, very hard. And another thing about being a teacher is it's on another level. Like, you know how to do the practice because you've done it. But it can't ever replace knowledge. You can watch other people do it and see them attain enlightenment. But if you haven't practiced for yourself, it's quite different. And so he practiced and practiced, and especially because he very much wanted to become enlightened, he didn't get anywhere. They're working so hard. And he wound himself up and wound himself up tighter and tighter and tighter until finally, you imagine how it is, he was so humiliated that he had gained nothing. Here he was, this great teacher who himself had no attainments, just disgusted with himself, and finally he just broke down and he started crying. Yeah, I'm worthless. I'm hopeless. How can I go back? I can't go back and face these people. They know I'm not enlightened. And he started crying. Just you know, this, because he was so wound up, pushing so hard. And then he hears someone else. He hears a sound beside him, and he turns. Again, this is a story. Believe it or not, up to you. But think of it as a story. He sees an angel sitting there, crying. Sitting beside him, crying, and he stops and he turns. He looks at this angel and he says, "Who are you?" And the angel says, "Oh, I'm the angel that guards these woods." He says, "Okay, why are you crying?" And the angel says, "Well, I saw you crying, and I know you're this great teacher, so I thought, well, that must be the way to become enlightenment. So I was following you." And this wakes the guy up, and he says, this is ridiculous. And then he finds the middle way. You see, often it takes this in your practice. You have to crash. You have to give up. I often tell students, they say, I give up. I can't do this. I say, good, good, good for you. Yes. Now start over. Because when you give up, when you stop trying to become enlightened, it's so much easier. You know, when you stay in the present, when you give up your goals and just learn to be mindful. Learn to see things as they are. Enlightenment is unconditioned. Nibbana is unconditioned. What that means is you can't cause it. It's not like we rub two sticks together and you have fire. It doesn't come from anything. Nibbana doesn't arise out of anything. It doesn't arise. So if you want to become enlightened, there's nothing you can do to cause it. All you can do is stop trying to cause things. Stop seeking, you know, start seeing. And so he did this, and he again became enlightened. Not from any teaching. Really, you could say from watching this angel and seeing how absurd he was being. And so the Buddha said, as someone who teaches is called Panyati Bahulo, someone who declares, or someone who sets up the Dhamma for others. No che Dhamma vihari, not a Dhamma vihari. So number two, also not a Dhamma. A third type of person is someone who recites the Dhamma. I get a little bit different. Panyati means someone who explains. Panyati is like, set, it literally means to set something up or to set something out. So like if you set out the Dhamma, it's a figurative way of speaking. If you set it out, it means you take the teaching and then you explain it, like I'm explaining it, you know, you expand upon something. That's panyati. But satyaya is just repeating it back, verbatim. So chanting, we do chanting of the suttas. It's a little bit maybe unfamiliar in modern day, but this is actually a big part of a Buddhist's life in ancient times. They would recite the teachings, remember them. Even in Buddhist countries, many people can chant the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Mangala Sutta, the Dajjaka Paritta, these kind of things. They remember and they can, the Ratana Sutta. So discourses of the Buddha they would repeat. And believe it or not, there are many people who believe that that makes you someone who lives with the Dhamma. It's a good Buddhist. You're a good Buddhist if you do that. If you chant the Buddha's teaching, you are accomplished. This is a Buddhist. This makes you Buddhist. So you would say this makes you someone who dwells in the Dhamma. It's a third type of Buddhist or someone who undertakes Buddhist activity. So we have a story for this as well. In the ancient times, there were two monks, two friends or brothers, I can't quite remember. But they did two very different things. One of them stayed in the monastery and studied the Buddha's teachings and memorized the Buddha's teachings and knew everything. You ask him anything about the Buddha's teaching, a lot like Duccha Potila, but he could recite anything. So people would go to him about anything. He became quite famous as a teacher because he could recite the Buddha's teaching. Another monk left the monastery quite early, knew basically nothing of the Buddha's teaching. He got a meditation subject, learned meditation from his teacher, from the Buddha or whoever. And then he just went off into the forest. And he lived there for, I can't remember, maybe many years, maybe just many months, but he lived there for quite some time. And then these two monks, sometime later, these two monks met up. And the teacher, the monk who had, they both had a following. So they both had monks who were following them. You had the monks who were interested in study, following the study monk. The monks who were interested in meditation, following the meditation monk. And this study monk couldn't believe that this monk who had learned nothing had all these followers. And so he was kind of disturbed by this, kind of thinking that, you know, really I have to teach these people that they're following the wrong monk, right? This guy doesn't know anything. He couldn't even recite one verse of the Buddha's teaching, I bet. And so he says, I'll go and set things straight. I'll talk Dhamma with them. And once they see that he knows nothing, then all of his followers will come and follow me where they should be, because I know everything. You can see where this is going. The Buddha catches wind of this. The Buddha had these powers to, he knew what was going on. And so he said, oh, that would be very bad karma for this monk. Turns out the other guy's an arahant. And the study guy, of course, is nothing. And so the Buddha says, I better go and get involved here. So the Buddha goes, as they're coming together, suddenly the Buddha appears and he sits down on a seat that they've prepared for him, because whenever monks congregated, they would always put out a seat for the Buddha. It's interesting. You wonder if that became a tradition where we should have a seat for the Buddha or something. Maybe in ancient times they didn't have Buddha images, they just had a seat. But at any rate, in the time of the Buddha, they would put out a seat. In case the Buddha came by. And so the Buddha sat down on this seat, and of course, well, now they can't talk, now they have to wait for the Buddha to talk. So the Buddha was quiet, and all these monks, the monks who are following the study monk, and the monks following the meditation monk sitting, and there are two divisions. And the Buddha looks at these two monks, And he asks, I think he asks the study monk, he asks him a question relating to the first jhana. And this monk, because he's never entered the first jhana, he can't answer. And he asks him a question about the second jhana and the third jhana. This monk can't answer any of these questions. He couldn't answer real questions about attainment, about understanding, because he didn't have any. Doesn't say what the questions were, but he asks questions about attainment. When I do a meditation course, the first meeting we have after you've done, the second meeting, so after a couple of days of practice, we give you one day and then we give you another day. After 2 days of practice, we ask you some questions. Very similar to this. Not questions you can get in a book. Most people who have studied get them wrong right away. You have to send them back for another day. Simple questions. You know, I'll give you an example. When you walk, stepping right, stepping left, right and left, are they one thing or separate things? And if you haven't been practicing, it's not an easy thing to answer. So you get people saying, well, what do you mean? Or it depends how you look at it or so on. And then you have the person who's meditating saying, well, that's easy. You know, I won't give you the answer, but we have questions like that. So ask a series of questions. And if you answer them all, then you've been meditating. You can tell. If not, it's clear. If you've just been just thinking or trying to find the answer from book knowledge or something, difficult questions to answer. And so the Buddha said this sort of person is a person who memorizes and recites and is able to repeat back what the Buddha has said. This is, again, not a Dhamma Vihari, of course. It's called Satchaya Bahulo. Satchaya means to recite. Someone who can parrot back the Buddha's teaching. So that's three. The fourth one. And again, all of these monks, all of these Buddhists have studied the teachings. In fact, the fifth one, who is, of course, going to be our Dhamma Vihari, is also studied. So it's important not to misunderstand. Studying the Dhamma is very important. It's actually the basis. The Buddha assumes that a good Buddhist will have studied, will have learned the basis. Because Ravi was saying this earlier. Can you not hear me? Can you hear me when I talk? Oh, I'm sorry. I'll try to be, I'll use the mic more. He was saying that it's not enough to meditate. You have to study as well. You have to know the Dhamma. Now, why is that? Because meditation is not a thing, you know. People say, well, I've been practicing meditation. Well, that doesn't mean anything to me. That could mean anything. That could mean you sit there and, you know, you think about your homework, you know. You daydream. Maybe you write a story in your head. That could be meditation. So to think that you can just come and practice and, you know, practice meditation and become enlightened is very dangerous. There's meditation that will drive you crazy. I've seen it. I've seen people go crazy from meditation because they weren't meditating. I mean, they were, but what does that mean? Meditation could mean anything. If you don't have a solid foundation, you don't know where you're going. If you don't read the map and you just go wandering through the forest, how do you know which way to go? When you come to the river, do you know to turn left or turn right? You have no idea. So you guess. Who knows where you'll end up? End up walking around in circles. So it's important to have a basis for your meditation practice. Meditation, I think most of us are aware, is very important. But if you don't have a basis, if it's not grounded in very specific theory, then who knows where you'll end up. Not all roads lead to Rome. Someone said that to me. All roads lead to Rome. No, not every path leads to enlightenment. Some just lead you around in circles. Some go halfway. Some go in the other direction. One of my professors in Buddhism in university, he said he had a friend who whose meditation teacher, he seemed really like a sort of a wise person, but then one day he started teaching them a meditation to destroy a rival monastery or a rival meditation center. So they were all practicing meditation to that's actually a thing, I guess. No, it's the wrong principle will change your practice. So if you're thinking I'm saying don't study, and that's absolutely, you need to study. It's what you do with it. So number four, what do they do? This sort of person thinks about the Dhamma. Thinks a lot about the Dhamma. They think and they consider and they examine it from all sides and philosophize about it, wonder about it, worry about it, doubt about it. Is it true? Is this, you have modern scholars in the West saying, analyzing the Dhamma to see what is the authentic Dhamma. What was original and what is later? And they have all these weird ideas about how you categorize the teachings according. I'm sorry, not weird. I mean, maybe they're right, and they've done a lot of work. But why I kind of caution about that is, I met a man quite well known in Buddhist circles. I was really keen to meet him because he's one of the translators for the Pali Text Society. And he said he'd read the entire Tipitaka twice in Pali. I thought, wow, that's quite impressive. I hadn't even read it once in English. But he read the whole thing twice in Pali, using the Pali language. Well, he must really know the Dhamma. And he explained to me his theory on the Buddha's teaching. His theory on Buddhism is that you can't become enlightened now. The way that people became enlightened is by hearing the Buddha's voice. And the power of the Buddha's voice led you to enlightenment. This was his view. The power of the Buddha's sound of the Buddha, which is very strange. If you've ever read the Tipitaka, it's very hard to get such a theory out of the Buddha's teaching. But as amazed as some of us might be at that, this actually is a thing. People can read the entirety of the Buddha's teaching twice and still come up with quite strange views about it. This is what thinking can do. If you think about something, you start to make logical arguments, and A leads to B leads to C, and it's like that game of telephone, right? Your thoughts start to resemble something very much unlike the original teachings. And this disturbs your practice. Your meditation should not be about considering the Dhamma. A lot of people think they hear about the three characteristics. The three characteristics: impermanent, suffering, non-self. You know about these? These are very important teachings. This is why we can't be happy in the world. Because we're trying to find stability, satisfaction, and control. We do this with everything. We want a stable life, we like, happy to be in this vihara because I have a room and a day to day it's stable, I'm safe. When you have you buy a house because you want stability. Trying to find satisfaction, so we buy things that delight us, that please us. We engage in relationships that please us. We eat food and partake of things that please us. And we try to control ourselves. We try to control our minds. We try to control our bodies, keep them healthy, keep them in shape. We try to control our families. We try to control our lives. Be in control. We don't want things to go out of control. And this is why we suffer. Because it turns out the world is none of these things. There's nothing in the world that is permanent, nothing that is stable. that is ultimately stable, nothing that is satisfying. You can't take something and say this is going, it doesn't satisfy you because it's impermanent. When it's gone, what are you left with? You're left with your attachment to it. That's all you get. And it's not controllable. You can't say, now it's going to change like this, now it's going to change like that. Don't change, stop changing. And so when things go out of control, when things change, we suffer. Now, okay, that's a very core Buddhist doctrine. That's what we try to see when we practice, if you've ever heard of vipassana. When we practice vipassana, it's to see these three things. Now, many people think that what that means is you have to look at things and you have to consider, is that, yes, that's impermanent. Oh, look at that, that's impermanent. And you have to actually think about these things. And then somehow that supports your meditation practice. That's just one example, but this happens, and people will sit there and think about the Dhamma, and as a result, they never meditate. They never actually see impermanence because they're looking for it. My teacher said it's like, or I think actually he took it from the commentaries, it's like you go in a forest and you see a tiger. If you go into the jungle and you see a tiger, and once you see the tiger, then you say, okay, I've got to look for the tiger's stripes. And you try and find the tiger's stripes. Does that sound like a reasonable thing to do? What I mean is you see the tiger right there in front of you, and then you say, where are the tiger's stripes? And so you think about it and you try to find them, and that's the kind of how ridiculous it is, because it's right there. The tiger's right in front of you and the stripes are there as well. That means is when you look, when you actually see the tiger, when you actually see reality, you can't help but see the three characteristics. You don't have to go looking, and in fact it gets in your way. See, right now, that's impermanent suffering and non-self, right? Having to change your position. The mind, how is your mind? Impermanent? Maybe you like what I say in a second, but then you're like, oh man, it's been over an hour already. Impermanent. I thought this was going to be satisfying and it was nice for a while, and then it gets longer and longer. And I haven't even gotten to the good stuff yet. Impermanent suffering and non-self. So anyway, that's not the point here, is this idea of vitakka, thinking, reflecting, pondering the Dhamma. I have a story that's somewhat related, and it's a very short story, but it's an example that is quite interesting to me. It's something just, you find these things just tucked away in the Buddha's teaching. It's a story of Anuruddha. Does anybody know who Anuruddha is? Anuruddha's got some great stories about him. Briefly, to go back, in ancient times he was a servant, and he gave some food to this Pacheka Buddha, a private Buddha. And then his boss wanted to buy the goodness from him. He said to him, sell that to me. That's all, you gave food to a Pacheka Buddha, to this holy man. I'll give you 5,000 gold coins I'll give you some gold coins if you give me that merit. Give me the goodness that you have gained. And he thinks to himself, but I want this goodness to myself. He said, what happens when someone buys goodness? And so he goes back to the Pacheka Buddha and he asks him, and he says, you don't have to sell it, you can just give it. You give goodness, it's more goodness. It's like the Pacheka Buddha says, if you have a candle, and someone comes and says, hey, can I light my candle off yours? Do you lose your light? And he said, no, you get two lights. The same way. In fact, you get more light, because goodness, when you share goodness, if I do something good, like I tell you, yesterday I went and taught, the three of us, there were two monks two male monks and a female monk, and we taught together. When I tell you that, and you all say, oh, that's very good, I'm sharing the merit with you, I say, the goodness that we gained in that group, may you all benefit from it as well. May that be a blessing for all of you. And then you feel good about it, more merit is gained, more goodness is gained. So we do this in Buddhism. We tell each other about good things that we do. Not to brag, but to give other people an opportunity to appreciate. Mudita, right? And anyway, the story goes that because of that goodness and the great goodness of Aniruddha, he never heard the word nati. He made a determination. He said, through the power of this, may I never hear the word nati. And nati means there isn't any. So what he means is, may I always have. May I never even hear the words, there's none. So when I ask for something, may I always get it. And in his last life, he was born as Aniruddha, and this happened. He never heard these words until finally he was playing marbles or whatever, and he was betting, they were betting cakes. Whoever lost had to bring cakes. So he loses and he has to have his mother bring some cakes. He sends a servant to his mother. He's a rich guy. So mother sends a servant back with some cakes, and it happens again, and he does the same thing. It happens again, and they run out of cakes. And the mother says, go back and tell Aniruddha nati. There aren't any. And the servant goes and says, nati. Your mother says, nati. I mean, this is Pali, of course, but the words are nati. And Aniruddha says, nati. What does that mean? And nati cakes. And okay, well then bring the nati cakes. You know, that's fine. I don't, whatever kind. It doesn't really matter. I've lost. I have to pay up. And the servant goes back to the mother and relates what happened. And this mother is just amazed. She says, can it be that he doesn't know what this word means? Can it be that I've spoiled him so badly that he's never heard these words? And she thinks it's a bad thing. So she says, I've got to teach him a lesson. She takes a platter, puts a cover over it, empty, and says, take this back to Aniruddha and tell him that's what nati means. The angels up in heaven find out about this. And they look down and they say, we can't allow this to happen. He made a vow, you know, it's a powerful vow. And so they stick some heavenly cake, some angel, real angel food cake, under the platter, or under the cover. And the servant doesn't know, so the servant brings this tray to the boys and pulls the lid off, and the smell just permeates the whole playground. And the taste is, of course, this is real angelic food. It's just a story. And Aniruddha gets furious. And he rushes, storms back to his mother and says, mother, you never loved me before. And she says, I'm sorry, but from now on I will only eat nutty cakes. I will not eat anything else. If you never served me this good food before, how could you be so unkind? Anyway, totally unrelated. I apologize. That was a bit of a tangent. But these are the stories of Aniruddha to give you an idea of who he was. Before he became ordained, it was either him or his brother who were going to ordain. And his older brother says, well, Aniruddha, you have to choose. You either become a farmer, the lord of this, you know, the estates, and look after these estates, or else you become a monk, and I'll do the other. You choose. And he says, well, gee, becoming a monk, that sounds really, really difficult. I've heard that that's, you know, really a hard thing. I'll stay as a layperson. I'll be the estate owner. Tell me what I have to do. And he says, okay. So you have to look after the farmers. You have to make sure the crops get in, and you have to, you know, look after the livestock. You have to look after the mill. You have to bring the food, bring the grain, make sure it gets to market. You have to pay everyone their wages, and on and on. And Aniruddha's eyes get wide because he's an innocent. He's not really a bad person. He just has never really been taught these things. And so he says, enough, I'll become a monk. And so that's how Aniruddha became a monk. But he happened to be very powerful in his meditation practice. And the Buddha said he was highest in magical powers, not like Moggallana, but he had some specific type of magical powers. So anyway, the story that I wanted to tell was Aniruddha comes to Sariputta, and he's concerned about his practice, getting back to this idea of vitakka. He says, Venerable Sariputta, I don't know what's wrong. I think I'm doing everything right. He says, oh, well, tell me about your meditation. So I'm able to hold the entire universe or solar system, I think solar system, in my awareness. You know, I'm able to do that. I have this ability to grasp the entirety of the cosmos in my awareness. And my mind is firmly established. My mind is firmly settled. I have perfect concentration. And yet, I still haven't seen Nibbana. You know, I don't know where it is. Can't find it. I still haven't given up the defilements. And Sariputta, why I like this story is because of what Sariputta says. It's quite surprising and it cuts to the core. He says, you holding all that cosmos stuff in your mind, that's vitaka. That's distraction. Vitaka, it's distraction. You telling me that your mind is firmly focused, you have perfect concentration, that's conceit. And he says, you worrying about the fact that you haven't attained enlightenment, that's worry. He says, give up those three things and you'll become free. You'll free yourself. A very good example of what happens in meditation. We make too much of it and get lost as a result. Doing everything technically correct, but thinking too much, overthinking, right? Meditation is very simple. Ditte ditta matang bhavisati. When seeing, let it just be seeing. It sounds too simple. It can't be that easy. It's not easy because we make it too complicated. We could keep it simple. We could free ourselves from all the baggage. Anyway, so the Buddha said, this type of person is also not a Dhamma Vihari. What sort of person is someone who dwells by the Dhamma? So now we get to the end, and I apologize for going over time. If you have to leave, you're welcome. This is all being recorded as well, so if you want, you can hear it online later. But there are two types, there are two suttas, so altogether there are four things that make you a Dhamma Vihari. So listen up, these four things, quite simple. First you have to learn, so that's basic, but after you've learned the Dhamma, there are four things that the Buddha says that make you a Dhamma Vihari. The first one, nat divasang atinamiti, don't let the days pass you by. Don't waste your time. The Buddha said, the Buddha is, I think, the original source of the quote, don't let the moment pass you by. Literally, that's an exact word-for-word translation of the Buddha, of something the Buddha said. Gano wo ma upachaga. You know, we have this carpe diem, seize the day, but for most people it means, you know, eat, drink, and be merry. Don't let the moment pass you by means right now. No success comes from the future. Don't waste your time. You shouldn't be doing anything else. Or nothing else should be at the core. Everything else you do should be to support your spiritual practice, not the other way around. Spiritual practice isn't a hobby that you do on the weekend. This is the first thing. How you become someone who truly lives in the Dhamma, you do it now. Right now. As you're listening to this talk, are you just listening for the information or are you mindful? Are you aware? Are you cultivating objectivity or are you sitting there, when is it going to be over? Are you looking at your mind and at your reactions, positive reactions, negative reactions? Are you learning? Now. Don't wait. Because these other four, that's what they've done. The Buddha says they've let the days go by. They're content with something they shouldn't be content with. It's not enough. Number two, na rinchati patisalanang. Not leaving behind, or not ignoring, not discarding solitude. Because that's generally what these others do. They fail to appreciate solitude. Rinchati means to leave behind, so it's just the way it's translated. But what it means is appreciate solitude. Stay to yourself. Take the time. I mean, you think about it, how much time do we actually spend alone? And I don't mean playing on Facebook. That's not alone anymore. We're alone a lot of the time now, but we're sitting in front of these things, chatting with people. Like. That's not alone. That's not solitude. How much time do we have our own space. We can find space. You go to the park, you can find your own space. You go into your bedroom, you have your own space. But what do? We find some way to connect. We find some way to get back into the mix of things. Take the time, you have it. Find your space, find your solitude, and look inside, because that's where the truth is. Truth isn't in talking to other people or discussing the Dhamma, comparing your practice, debating, arguing. It's all within you. The Buddha said, the beginning of the world is here, the end of the world is here. The beginning of suffering is here, the end of suffering is within this 6-foot frame, he said. So this is number 2. Number 3, anuyunjati ajatang jeto samatam. The third one is cultivating calm. If you want to become enlightened, if you want to be someone who dwells with the Dhamma, so you have to stay alone, you have to take the opportunity, seize the day. And then what do you do when you're alone? You have to cultivate this tranquility inside. So we talk a lot about mindfulness, and we talk about wisdom. We talk about Buddhism as though it's relating to understanding, and understanding is the goal. The final goal is to see the truth. Before you can see the truth, you need what the Buddha called samatha. Many of you know this word. Samatha means tranquility. It's like if you're looking in a pool of water or a pot of water, and the pot of water is boiling, or the pot of water is had dye poured into it, or the pot of water is dirty, is full of mud stirred up, or it's there's foam over it, or there's gunk on the top. All these defilements of the mind that keep us distracted, that keep us agitated, prevent us from seeing clearly. You can't see clearly if the instrument by which you're seeing is all covered in grime and dirt or is not clear. So the beginning of our meditation practice is actually a lot more about calming down. Some people will actually do specific meditations to calm themselves. Many of you know the word jhana. A jhana is a state where you're perfectly calm. No liking or disliking or drowsiness or distraction or doubt. Perfect state of mind. And so people will practice this and cultivate this. You don't have to. You can begin to practice and begin to be mindful and cultivate insight. But the first thing that's going to happen is your mind will have to calm down. You have to straighten things out in your mind and become comfortable with the practice. So you don't worry too much, especially in the beginning, about insight. Don't go looking for it. Once your mind is clear and calm, and if you're looking at reality, even looking at the calm, for example, you will see clearly. You'll begin to see impermanence. You'll begin to see suffering. You'll begin to see non. You'll see how the things that we cling to are not what they appear to be. And you'll start to let go of them. You'll start to see clearly. So this is number 4. To wrap up, number 3 is the samatha. Number 4 is the seeing clearly. And what the words the Buddha used are uttaricasa panyaya atang pajanati. I repeat the Pali because I want to explain it. Uttari means higher. Higher than that. Uttari jasa is that which you've higher than that Dhamma. Attang pajanati. To know clearly the meaning, the atta, of all the teachings that you've learned. When you've studied the Buddha's teaching, when you've listened to people talk, all of that you've learned. to find the higher wisdom, or the higher meaning with wisdom. To know that about impermanent suffering and non-self, to know about the Four Noble Truths, but to know it by seeing it. The Buddha used the words sacchikaroti, which means to see, to make it as though you see it with your own eyes. Sa-achi, achi is the eyes, sa-aki, to see with your own eyes. The Dhamma I've been saying this a lot lately, I think it bears repeating. The Dhamma is not something that you're going to expect. Enlightenment is not something you can say, oh, well, that's about what I thought it would be. Absolutely, 100% not. It can't be. Because not only is it something we've never seen or gotten close to in this life, it's something in the whole round of samsara, it's infinite, we have never. It's totally unrelated to who we are, who we've been, where we've been, what we've done, everything we've come to know, all the wisdom that you've gained outside of the path, unrelated. So it will surprise you. If it doesn't surprise you, I would claim that you're not there yet. You will see things about yourself that you never saw before. You'll start to learn things about yourself that they're so obvious, really, but that you've just never seen. And then you'll go deeper and deeper, and finally you will come to this point where you see sabbe sankhara anicca, all sankharas, all formations are impermanent, they're all suffering. All dhammas are non-self, you can't control. Control is not a thing. And you let go. And letting go, then you attain nibbana, you're free. When you're free, you'll say, I'm free. So seeing, this is the goal, seeing